in terms of mental health, you can present with panic, anxiety, depression. And I've had that happen. People present with a symptom, but when I actually find out more from the history, they're also having significant gastrointestinal distress. And by helping heal the gut, it actually simply put heals the mind.
Hi everyone, Drew Perdy here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. In today's episode, we have Dr. Uma Naidu, who's a Harvard-trained psychiatrist who's here to talk to us all about food and mental health, food and mood. The research in the last few years has completely exploded. You know, it used to be that you'd go to a doctor, especially a psychiatrist, and you'd say, hey, does my diet have anything to do with how I'm thinking, feeling, my depression, my anxiety, my OCD? And these well-meaning individuals, I know my dad was a CFO of a group of psychiatric hospitals, they would often say, no, there's no strong link that's out there. There's not enough studies, or there's no studies. And their lack of awareness was simply that. It was a lack of awareness of the emerging literature that's out there. Dr. Uma Naidu has a mission. She wants to destroy this lack of awareness by highlighting all the incredible research that's out there and how much we know when it comes to food and our mental health. That's what her new book is all about. We talk all about it in today's episode. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, and mindset. I'm your host, Drew Perdy, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and live more. This week's guest is Dr. Uma Naidu. Dr. Naidu is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist, professional chef, yes, professional chef, and nutrition specialist. Her niche work is in nutritional psychiatry, and she is regarded both nationally and internationally as a medical pioneer in this more newly recognized field. Dr. Naidu founded and directs the first hospital-based clinical service in nutritional psychiatry in the U.S. It's a big deal. She is the director of nutritional and lifestyle psychiatry at Mass General Hospital. She's also the author of a newly released book, which we're going to be talking about today, This Is Your Brain on Food, which is truly an indispensable guide to the surprising foods that fight depression, anxiety, PTSD, OCD, ADHD, and more. Dr. Naidu, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thanks so much for hosting me, Drew. I really appreciate it. I feel excited to talk to you.
Yeah, no, it's an honor to have you here. And we were just chit-chatting about a little bit of our common background, how our families are both fourth generation from Africa, your family from South Africa and Kenya. So separate from the fact that we're South Asian and the similar backgrounds, I just want to say, having read your book, I feel like you were the ideal guest for this podcast. You know, this podcast is called Broken Brain, and it's really about how our brains aren't broken and highlighting all the information and the tools that are out there and the research that is quickly emerging in this area to show us what's possible when it comes to our mental and physical health of our body and our brain. So thank you for the work that you're doing. The fact that you come from a fantastic pedigree that you do is really putting a spotlight on this topic that I think a lot of people previously would have written off as soft interventions. So I just want to say that's a long-winded way of saying I appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Drew. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, I think that nutrition in association with medicine has been thought of as a little soft. But I think that in association with mental health, what I've tried to share in the book is a lot of the research that currently exists behind it and to show individuals that there is science. And if you try it, it could work for you. So that's the hope.
It's a great message. You know, I like to start off these interviews often by comparing and contrasting. And one of the ways that I'd love to do that with your story is take us back to like the early days of your medical training in psychiatry. Looking back on those times, especially in contrast to your book now, what were you taught then and what were your beliefs about food and mental health?
Absolutely. That's a great question. We were taught very thoroughly, taught psychotherapy, taught about medications, but there really wasn't, and even at medical school, there really wasn't much taught on nutrition. And even in current times, our medical schools, we know, are behind in that, and certain medical schools are doing better than others. So doctors don't necessarily have this working, talking information. When I began to learn about psychiatric medications and I understood that there were serious side effects, I felt that my patients needed more than just the medication. I've always believed in a very holistic model of care. That's probably my South Asian roots, you know, in terms of having a mind-body connection and always thinking a little bit out of the box than people were at the time that I was in training about how else can people feel better, not just a medication. And I brought that that background with me, and I would start to talk to people about, you know, the famous story of the gentleman who came in and was yelling at me about Prozac, but he also had this 20-ounce cup of coffee, and when we broke it down, it was exactly Boston. You know, quarter cup of cream and 6 to 8 sugars. And if he was having that every day, right there were ways that he was adding on unhealthy calories to his diet that were also possibly causing weight gain. And just giving people practical examples began to be part of what I was doing with individuals. I can't say that it was mainstream. I would incorporate it into the patient questions I was asking. And from there, that interest grew. I will say that culinary school was just following a passion. I'd love to say to people I had a grand plan for this, but I didn't. It really was following things that I loved to do. And compared to now, I think that people are speaking about nutrition more. The Food Network has completely emerged over the last several decades. So people just have an awareness of food, not necessarily the nutrition, but they're aware of and they're interested in cooking and doing more things. And I think that that has helped. But nutritional psychiatry is considered a nascent field. And my book is really about showing people that there are more than one ways to feel better in mental health. And it doesn't exclude medications.
Yeah, it's about tools in the toolbox. But one thing that you said earlier is, I think, something important, especially in the context of a pandemic and a mental health crisis that we were already going through pre-coronavirus, and now coronavirus has exacerbated it. More individuals are seeking out help from their physicians, psychiatrists, their mental health providers. Yep. And I don't think that people are often fully aware, including practitioners, about the limitations of medications. So medications are great, and they are tools in the toolbox. Food is tools in the toolbox. But what were some of the, you were mentioning earlier that when you started to become aware of some of the side effects and some of the limitations, what were some of those things that you were bumping up against when you were working with patients in the early days?
Exactly. One of them was weight gain. Some people develop weight gain on, you know, SSRI medications, which basically are used for anxiety and depression, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Celexa, Lexapro. They might feel better, but there are two things that happen. They might also develop side effects. Some of them include things like weight gain and sexual side effects. But the other is that they not everyone gets better with the medication, and that's the other thing I was finding. And studies have shown that only a certain percentage of people do improve. So it just felt from the outset that we needed to have more tools, as you well put it, Drew, in the toolbox, and more opportunities for people to feel better. To me, it seemed obvious, because food was so important to me, to include that as, well, if you're going to take this medication, why not think about ways that you could adjust your diet so that you could, you know, stave off any weight gain, so that you could exercise more. And you think about other ways that you can help anxiety. Meditation was not talked about in mainstream medicine, you know, at the time that I was training. Although I was at the hospital where Henry Benson started his work, and I trained there, and then he moved his program to Mass General. And the Benson-Henry Institute does a lot of that mindfulness and has grown that as well over the years. But honestly, in day-to-day life, sitting with patients, we were not discussing that. So you were right to pick up on it, and the fact that it wasn't really part of our language. So introducing it was definitely new. Certain patients are not open to it. They would associate, if I mentioned healthful movement, you know, someone who was depressed may not be able to get to the gym and exercise a certain amount, but they might be able to do gentle yoga. Well, you know, sometimes people had a misconception about yoga. It's so much more mainstream now than it was. So all of those components were a new conversation, and one that I developed under mentorship, but also felt that my patients needed to know about.
Now, it's one, you know, a lot of healthcare practitioners will tell their patients, you know, eat healthy, exercise, but those recommendations are often so generalized, and they're not always shared in the context of the integrated way that the body works. You know, inside your book, you talk about these old ideas that are still pervasive in medicine about how the organs in our body operate in sort of silos and that they don't really have anything to do with one another. So often when those recommendations are brought in of, you know, eat healthy or exercise, it's just kind of like, well, just eat healthy and exercise and maybe it'll work a little bit. It's not very specific to what's going on. When did you first start to realize that the body is not these separate parts that are working on their own, but that they're actually deeply connected to one another, and especially when it comes to our mental health?
I think that in part, that feeling and that sense that we are all in one body and there's a connection between mind, body, soul, mind, body, spirit, really came from my cultural background. I think you can probably relate to that. There was always just a sense of more ways to feel better, more ways to heal.
If I could interject for a second, did you grow up with parents who would give you different, like, home remedies or Ayurvedic treatments?
Absolutely. My grandmother was full of those. And so is my mom. You know, my mom's a double boarded physician, but she also knew and had that background. So it was very much a part of how I grew up. And I think I brought that with me. And what started to make sense in practicing in psychiatry and as a physician was that we needed more tools. We just needed more than existed. And that came, I think, more from my sense of self and how I was raised and feeling that mentioning things to individuals is not harmful. It's not toxic if you talk to people and have a conversation about here are other ways that you can feel better. I also was getting, you know, research was coming out that our medications were effective, but up to a point. There was also burgeoning research on the metabolics of certain psychiatric medications that, you know, could be diabetogenic and that type of stuff. And I was getting more and more concerned that people just needed to do and know more. Because on the one hand, someone was severely ill needs those medications, but why not also include dietary measures to help them feel better? And you also correct about the fact that as doctors, you know, we say, well, eat this for hypertension and, you know, this is what you need to do for cholesterol, but no one links that with mental health. And my hope is that people will just have some easy ways to unpack this information, understand that the gut and the brain are central to a lot of these conditions. The body it's sort of, we're all in the same body and we're also connected to other things. So one organ really cannot function without the other. We highly, highly specialized in medicine. So, you know, whether you're seeing an allergist or a gastroenterologist or an orthopedist, you're seeing totally different doctors. But I think for mental health, people can develop symptoms of mental health issues such as panic and anxiety when they have underlying inflammation from a completely different cause. So that's a good way to try to put it together for people and then really break down the gut-brain axis for them.
So I'd love to cover, you know, we've done many episodes on gut and the gut-brain, but it's always nice for our listeners to be reminded, and obviously there's always new listeners that are coming in. You know, your opening of the book, you talk about the romance between the gut and the brain, right? The first time that I had really even heard anything about the gut was 20 years ago. I was just graduating high school and on my first year to university. And I was looking for answers to figure out why is my acne still not any better that I was going through at the time.
There you go. Yeah.
And I ended up at a conference in the Jain community from that background, because that's my side that my mom comes from. And I saw a speaker say, know a lot, but there seems to be some link with dairy and inflammation in the gut. And I was like thinking, what the heck are they talking about? I've never heard this before. So give us the basics. What are the link between the gut and the brain, and what role does inflammation play in that process when it comes to disease?
Well, firstly, good for you that you had such a curious mind, because, you know, it's more mainstream now, but it wasn't at that point. And skin conditions are one of the things that are a result. But, you know, the way that I explain it to people is that really from whence we were formed as fetus in the uterus, the cells formed from, you know, from when we talk about biology back in high school. But here's the thing. The gut and the brain are connected by the vagus nerve, and it runs between the gut and the brain in our bodies. It connects them, and it's this bidirectional superhighway of connecting substances that travel back and forth. That's one important thing for people to understand. The second thing is that serotonin receptors, so serotonin, the happy hormone through which many of our psychiatric medications work, the receptors, more than 90%, are located in the gut. Also, a large component of our immune system is in the gut. So, you know, some people call the gut the second brain, and for good reason, because there are the 39 trillion bacteria that live there. In a single day, within 24 hours, research has shown that what you eat can impact those bacteria. You may not change, you may not feel it emotionally or see it physically, but the bacteria can start to change. And that is one way to understand that if you eat healthy, it will help your good bacteria. If you eat in an unhealthy way, almost immediately, within 24 hours, it will start to prop up your bad bacteria. And that's the balance of the good and bad bacteria, which I'm sure your audience has heard before, is really what we want to keep in a positive balance. Because when dysbiosis sets in and the bad bugs are thriving, you know, feeding all the fun, yummy foods that are not good for us, those take over. And that's when inflammation sets in. And from inflammation over time, you can develop leaky gut or intestinal permeability. You develop other problems. You can develop skin rashes. You can develop other forms of inflammation. But most importantly, in terms of mental health, you can present with panic, anxiety, depression, and I've had that happen. People present with a symptom, but when I actually find out more from the history, they're also having significant gastrointestinal distress. And by helping heal the gut, it actually, simply put, heals the mind. So
now let's talk about a little bit more details on the bacteria. You know, when it comes to certain foods that are more pro-inflammatory, right? Mm-hmm. Let's take sugar, for example. Let's say if somebody has a lot of sugar inside of their diet, regardless of what forms it's kind of coming from, sure. Right? How is that actually promoting the bad bacteria? Like, what mechanisms are going on that it would support the bad and not the good?
Sure. So I think that a nicer way for me to frame it for people would be, there are certain foods that are just going to help the good bacteria thrive. And those foods really center on fiber. And fiber you can't get from seafood or from animal proteins. You get them from fruits, vegetables, beans, nuts, seeds, legumes, and healthy whole grains. What happens when you add in a bunch of sugar, in whatever form it is, added sugar or processed foods, is that the sugar creates an environment in the gut where the bacteria that are healthy and really your armor, those bacteria need fiber. They need the substrates and the substances and fiber and things like probiotics, which come from fermented foods, the active cultures in dairy and non-dairy yogurts that are available now to thrive. So if they get fed right, they are stronger. With sugar, the bad bugs essentially do the same thing because they thrive on the bad substances. So they absorb that sugar and they pretty much have a party in your gut. But the problem is by doing that, they overcome the good bacteria. And that's when inflammation, that's when dysbiosis and inflammation start to set in. The issue is that when someone's eating a ton of sugar, they may actually be getting it through forms like processed foods and candy bars. The processing, the dyes, the stabilizers, the ingredients that are added to all of that compared to the other side of things where you're eating plants, vegetables, fruit, lean proteins, and things like that as part of a healthy diet, there's a complete imbalance. And those bad bacteria then start to thrive and cause problems.
You know, there's been people that have been saying this for a while, but when you really look at your book, I see it as like a collection of also, you're sharing this information, but you're also talking about the real explosion and emergence of research and studies to back all that information up. You know, even as early as like earlier in the year, I was reading a Medscape article in preparation of another podcast, and I pulled a quote from there. It said, although diet can influence mental health and cognitive function, the evidence of benefit from any specific diets is actually quite weak. And you see that a lot, people saying that there's no evidence and it's just like a blanket way. Why do you think that is, and what's changed over the last 10, 15 years?
So a lot of, I appreciate you saying that, Drew, because I've also seen that a lot. And I sort of think to myself, well, I think that's where perhaps some of the information in this book could be useful, even to clinicians. A lot of it comes from not necessarily knowing how to interpret the nutritional science. And I want to be clear that I'm not standing on a soapbox saying we know every single fact about nutrition and mental health. I think that what we know how to interpret. And what I do in my Instagram feed and the posts that we write about, we try to provide a research article, one or two, that links a fact that helps people understand this is why something is happening in my body. For example, a study that looked at ethnicity being related to gut bacteria, which hadn't been shown before, and that a certain group of certain type of population was struggling more with ulcerative colitis, and ulcerative colitis is linked to depression. Sometimes those individuals present with depression. And what it showed was that by adjusting the diet, when I put together certain studies and looked at it, by adjusting their diet, and including things like folate and certain B vitamins, they could help the growth of the bacteria that was lacking in them due to this ethnic background. You know, I think that if you don't know some of that work, or you're not following it and reading up on it all the time, you might think, oh, you know, one more doctor telling me to eat my leafy greens, one more doctor telling me, or one more nutritionist or clinician telling me eat a salad. But actually, when you find out that folate in leafy greens can help a certain bacteria thrive that will help your gut and reduce your ulcerative colitis, that's helpful for people to know. I looked at 700 references approximately, and we whittled it down to about 550 that made it into the book. But the challenge was making it digestible, making it readable, that people look at it and can find some healthy and useful nutrition information for mental health, but also know there's science behind it. And that's really what we made the focus of it about, that someone may call it a soft science, but my rebuttal to that would be, well, look at the evidence, you know, read the book, have a look at, you know, what we've cited. If you disagree, I'm open to a discussion about it. But I think there's more than people realize out there. And
it's almost like a lack of awareness.
It's a lack of awareness. That's it.
And medicine falls prey to that too, because human beings, which run everything, they're not always going to be aware of stuff, right?
Exactly.
You look at any category.
This is your interest. Yeah.
And this is part of medicine, is people making it aware. And actually, it's so beautiful that social media and podcasting, often social media gets a bad rap for putting out misinformation. But the truth is, there's also way more positive information and interviews like this that get out there that help, you know, somebody who wasn't aware of something be aware, and they can dig into it a little bit deeper. So in preparation and putting and compiling these over 500 studies together for the book, was there one that really was a darling that you felt was like, highlighting really the emerging branch of evidence that's coming in to support the connection between food and mood and food and mental health?
I think the one that for me, that stood out, and it was related to a more serious diagnosis in mental health, being schizophrenia. They did a study, an animal study. And that's the other thing I would just say is, a lot of our scientific research starts off with animal studies. So people really shouldn't just push those aside, because a lot of our extrapolation and our clinical correlations come originally from that, and then we do more human studies. So I'll just preface it by saying that, because I also hear a lot of people say, oh, that's just an animal study, but there's still evidence. You still have to look at the power of the study, how it was done, and assess scientifically, and especially from the nutrition aspect, is it worth paying attention to? And I'll just preface it by saying that.
And could I add one more thing to there?
Yeah.
Another part of it too is that there's not a lot of money that's floating around for these studies to then take them to humans, right? So it's like you have to show excitement, you have to show momentum, you got to talk to donors, you have to talk to institutions and say, look, here's what we're seeing, at least in animals. It's showing us that there's probably some possibility. Exactly. And it's almost like you're your own campaign manager. You have to go raise the funds to then do these studies in humans.
To do these studies. And I thank you for saying that, because pharmaceutical companies are very well funded. You know, it's a very it's a $1 million, if not more, industry. But nutrition studies have significantly less research funding behind them.
Right, because we can't patent the spinach. We can't patent these other items that are there.
And honestly, if someone ate spinach and didn't need a medication, you know.
Yeah, what are you going to get? So sorry for interrupting you, but you were saying about the study that you were going to talk about.
Yeah. And essentially what happened was they took germ-free mice, meaning that they breed these mice or these little animals that don't have bacteria yet in the microbiome. And they did a transplant from individuals who had schizophrenia. And when they did the fecal microbiome transplant, the mice developed symptoms of schizophrenia. So the study was a little bit more complicated, but what I took away from that was mind-blowing for myself, which is that something in the microbiome of those individuals with a serious mental illness could be transported and conveyed to an animal who didn't have a microbiome yet. They bred that way. So they called germ-free mice and developed symptoms. So the power of that taught me that, you know, the microbiome has so many things that we still need to and learn to understand, and how can we best use it for our advantage, for our ongoing research, and really to help people heal. Like you said, you know, whether it's a skin condition or whether it's some other symptom in the body that they've developed inflammation, how can we use this? It's a powerful system, and I really do believe that the gut is like the second brain, because there's so much going on there that we can learn and study more about.
You know, when people hear that you are a trained chef, right? First of all, you mentioned in your book, but they assume that you've been cooking forever, and you really got into cooking later on in life and spent some time in the Culinary Institute. In that process of developing this firsthand relationship with food, and also then having your psychiatric background and kind of digging into the research and seeing more and more of the emerging research showing the connection between food and mental health, what did you notice when it came to your own health and the foods that you were having? And you've been open about your breast cancer story. We'll talk about that in a second. But did you notice any connection between, you know, even if you didn't have a diagnosable mental health issue, mm-hmm. did you notice anything about the foods that you were consuming at the time as you were finding more information and your mood on a day-to-day basis?
So, you know, what I found was that I was, even though I was, you know, a physician at that point and had been delving more into nutrition, I sort of went on my own educational journey because I realized I wasn't that much of a healthy eater. I mean, I wasn't necessarily living on pizza and ice cream or something like that, which, by the way, is delicious and it's meant for a treat day, but it shouldn't be something that a person is eating every day. But what I found was that I learned more and I understood where there were added sugars. I understood where there were processed foods, that so many things we take for granted and eat are actually processed. And are there ways that you can use three ingredients to make your own pasta? Or are there ways, and I know it's hard work and it requires a bit more, but are there ways that you can do things a little bit differently? Are there vegetables you could embrace more? Could you expand the rainbow of foods that you eat? So when I learned those things, I understood that I wasn't the unhealthiest eater, but I could do a lot better. And that helped me tweak my own journey in terms of embracing more salads, making them be very, very colorful, challenging myself to add more vegetables in, you know, exploring different types of protein, understanding where the fiber came from. So I tweaked it as I went along, and really to change things up and make them interesting, I used my cultural background. I used spices to make things different and to make them more flavorful. And really, I enjoyed cooking. I think that's the mindfulness piece came to me where I was looking forward to what I was doing and preparing, and that made me want to experiment more. And I think that I just want to say that no person's journey is perfect. I've eaten lots of things that I probably shouldn't have. But the way that I've taught myself or learned about myself to be better about it is not regret it. You know, you have that piece of cheesecake at dinner, enjoy it, move on. And the next day get back on track about the healthy foods that I incorporate every day. I think that's important for people to understand, because having a treat day when you enjoy something is important. And I don't like the word diet because it makes people feel they have to give up and restrict foods. And I much rather talk to them about the things they can add back into their diet.
Yeah, it's really all about strengthening the connection between what you eat and how you feel. And the challenge is, because of how processed our diets have gotten, it's very difficult for a lot of people to make that connection because so many things have sugar, so many things have, you know, too high omega-6 fats without any like omega-3. So you eat different things and you're not actually sure how it makes you feel. I guess this is the benefit sometimes of going on an elimination diet or trying to dissect a little bit more to see, do you feel differently because of dairy? Do you feel differently because of gluten? On the topic of gluten, you have some really interesting things to share inside of the book that you found out. Can you talk to us a little bit about gluten and mood and brain health?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think elimination is important when someone's having symptoms, right? I think that's very true. If someone comes in with discomfort, you want to look at what they're eating and personalize that treatment plan for them. But studies have actually shown a significant association between levels of anxiety and eliminating gluten. So studies show that if people eliminated gluten, even if they didn't have celiac disease or non-celiac glucose sensitivity, they actually felt better and there was a reduction in their symptoms of anxiety. So I think that, you know, if people are eating gluten, they should embrace healthier sources, healthier whole grain sources, and also sourdough bread. That's a great example because of the fermentation process. It has a lower a level of sugar, and the fact that it's fermented is potentially good. So a well-sourced, you know, sourdough bread, it's not the nut necessarily something you have to give up. But if you're struggling, you're having bloating, discomfort, other symptoms that you could discuss with your doctor, you might have to give it up. And it's very helpful information to know. And when I've seen symptoms improve is when I realized that that person may just have to cut back on that ingredient.
You know, I grew up on a traditional Indian vegetarian diet, right? Yeah. And so, you know, bread was a big part of what we ate here in the US. That's not the diet that I eat now. But I can remember, especially in high school and early university, I would, you know, my father is a CFO of a group of psychiatric hospitals. He's now since retired. And I went through a major bout of, you know, looking back now, I wasn't diagnosed, but I was depressed, right? I was depressed. I was never prescribed medications. But at one point in time, my dad said, do you want to see one of the doctors at our, you know, hospital and everything that was there? And then right around in university, when I started to get into all this world before I found out about functional medicine, I started eliminating certain things. First was dairy because of my skin. And then somebody said, you know, you might want to be mindful a little bit about wheat. This is what we're learning. This is what's there. Yeah. Again, it sounded crazy. I'd never even heard the word gluten before. I didn't even know what it meant. And I took it out. And it was like somebody turned on a, this is not everybody, right? This was just my own experience. Somebody turned on a light bulb in my head and I didn't have these like long bouts of like the blues or in some cases what I felt was depression having taken it out of there. I didn't know what it was at the time, but that was just my own connection that I made.
That is amazing. I'm so delighted to hear that. And I'm also so glad that you tried that out. You know, that for that time frame was excellent that you had the awareness and the opening to do it. And I'm only saying that because many people come to that much later and perhaps because they don't think of food as a component that could be impacting that. You know, you asked me about times that if food directly impacted me, and it really kicked in for me that, you know, the book wasn't a reason. The book didn't come out of my diagnosis, but what happened was I was able to actually use the work that I was doing with others to, in a very live, active way, test it on myself. While I'd always tried to embrace healthier eating, you know, the morning that I started my first chemotherapy, I talk in the book, just in the introduction, very briefly about, it was quite a shock. I wasn't feeling unhealthy. And because I was blessed to have access to really great medical care, I was diagnosed and began treatment in a very short period of time. And for that reason, I think that my emotional self hadn't caught up, so I was still shocked. And when it really kicked in for me was when I realized that I could actually use these strategies because it wasn't going to impact my chemotherapy. My doctors knew what I was taking. They knew what I was eating and that I could do it for myself. And I experienced it you know, live. I experienced the ability to manage possible side effects, but also lower my anxiety through how I ate. And that was very powerful, mostly because my mood had been okay at the time. But I can tell you that when you face something like that, anxiety comes from nowhere. You know, you're overwhelmed, and you actually probably even more scared when you know the medications that you're about to receive. And while they might be on the one hand life-saving, they also have devastating side effects. So it's a scary feeling. And that was my live experiment. You know, that was
absolutely
that was what I had to do. Yeah.
Yeah. And you write about that in the book, and you share that story, and you talk a little bit about it in Dr. Hyman's podcast with him a little bit. Yeah, I can't imagine. You know, my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer many years ago. And in that process, it was also a wake-up call for her. You know, she always thought, like, she eats really healthy. It's not that cancer is directly linked with food, but food can have a helpful role in helping protect our body and our immune system and other stuff. In her case, you know, could have been some environmental factors, a whole host of things that
stress is also a big factor. Absolutely.
But it was sort of a wake up call to, like, look at every avenue of her health and say, how do I want to clean it up so that I can be my best version of myself, including support my mental health during this process that can be, you know, very anxiety provoking.
Exactly. And someone who may not have ever thought or felt that way before, it's a shock. And I agree. It's something we all, you know, I examine this every day in my life. So that was a big wake up call to say, well, you know, here I have thought about these things and I understand these things, but how can I up my game for my own health, mental and physical?
So speaking of upping your game, you know, what's been really beautiful to see, sometimes I don't really watch the regular news, you know, I kind of listen to more slow news, but every so often I'll get a friend or a sibling send me an article from like CNN or other places. And it's really beautiful to see in the last even 3 years, I feel 3-4 years, you've been seeing a lot more articles like, these are the foods that support mental health, these are the superfoods for this. So in the research, tell us, what actually have you seen when it comes to upping your game and supporting your brain health and your mental health? What foods can play a role in that process?
So, you know, there are some foods that overlap different diagnoses, and there are some foods that stand out. For example, you'll appreciate this, that in depression, there's a significant number of trials around saffron improving depression. So, you know, that's one that surprised me and I didn't know existed. Also, things like, you know, omega-3 fatty acids we know are good from healthy sources of seafood like salmon, fatty fish. But then, you know, there's also things in depression like chocolate, the flavonoids from super dark chocolate, more than 70%, the dark cacao help your brain. So it's helpful to know those things in addition to, you know, magnesium from avocado, you know, turmeric with a pinch of black pepper is a super healthy anti-inflammatory antioxidant. And, you know, drew a significant number of trials that help both anxiety and depression with turmeric. So those just off the bat are some of my go-tos in addition to others.
What's your favorite way of incorporating turmeric into your diet?
So, you know, I generally cook a lot of Asian and Indian food. So it's there. It's been there anyway. Always add the pinch of black pepper to make it more bioactive. But I like it one of my favorite things to do is to experiment with cauliflower, because I think of it as a blank canvas and I can be super creative. So I will mix, you know, tikka masala spices and put the turmeric in and use a probiotic rich yogurt, well-sourced, usually, you know, grass-fed milk-fed yogurt, and make some sort of a marinade for it, which I tend to like. So I like using turmeric in that way. But, you know, not everyone cooks with turmeric. It's so easy to get it these days. You can get it on, you know, most supermarket spice aisles, and some supermarkets even have an organic version. So I think that if you're not cooking with it, it's so easy to add it to a soup or a smoothie. You won't taste it. Quarter teaspoon a day and a pinch of black pepper. And I think it's an easy thing that people can do.
And obviously with our backgrounds, a lot of people know that turmeric is very common in the South Asian tradition. Yes. And it seems to be one of the things that people are paying attention to when it comes to potentially turmeric and some other spices, their anti-inflammatory properties as one of the components of Alzheimer's disease in India, which is obviously changing now as people there are adopting Western diets, but historically the lower rates of Alzheimer's in India.
Absolutely. There have been studies done that looked at, you know, the family system of sort of community living, and the fact that one of the things they found almost by chance was the one thing that was consistent was the diet was rich in turmeric. And black pepper was a natural part of the diet as well. And in everyday foods. And they made that association between better cognitive health. And you're actually right, the diet has changed and is changing. But traditionally, in with a lot of people, that's a staple diet.
It's a little sad to see because, you know, when I go to India, which is like every couple of years, I feel like they're eating more sugar than we're even eating over here. And it's natural. I feel like, you know, there's a spiritual teacher, Eckhart Tolle, who's I'm a big fan of his work. And he says, you know, it's in the nature of the universe and humanity to have something. You kind of take it for granted, right? Mm-hmm. Then you lose it. You rediscover it, but you actually rediscover it at a deeper level, understanding why it was important in the first place so that you fully bake it into like your existence. And I think that's a little bit of what's happening is that we're inheriting some of the beautiful things that India and many other cultures have taught us. They're forgetting about it a little bit, but they'll find it again. And then
it's so true.
That's part of the process.
It's so true. And you know, the thing about countries overseas is that there are thrills about American life that people love. You know, they love fast foods. And unfortunately, you know, those are the things that tend to get that diet awry. And, you know, things like, I wish more people knew that, you know, sugar is added to French fries. All fast food French fries have sugar because they've tried and tested research and development to make them hyper palatable. So they know that you can't not up the size of your fries. You can't stop eating them, but it's one of the reasons is they have sugar in them and you don't taste it, but it's tested. So it's those types of things about processed foods and fast foods that I just wish more people knew about, because once in a while a treat, traveling, you know, busy, flying through an airport, but, you know, as an option, absolutely, but not every day. And that I think is sometimes what's happening in countries overseas.
Exactly. Not every day. And also understand that those foods are designed that when you eat them, they're designed to make you want to eat them more. So you just kind of know what you're getting into, you know, what you're getting into and be aware. You know, one of the things of the many things that I love about your book is that each of the chapters is organized and kind of talking about different diagnoses or diseases and the evidence that goes to support those areas when it comes to food. And there's, you know, I feel like with the explosion of more awareness of nutritional psychiatry, even though it's not mainstream in the health space, there's people like yourself, Dr. Drew Ramsey, that are out there that are really championing. And most of the attention was placed on, I would say, depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. But there's chapters that are inside of your book that are like obsessive compulsive disorder.
Right.
And what do we know about obsessive compulsive disorder? A lot of people think, well, does that have anything to do with food and nutrients? So tell us about that.
Absolutely. So the interesting thing is that in one of the associations we found in OCD was that people really should try their best not to be having foods with MSG. Now we know that in MSG there are certain we know in, for example, certain types of cuisine that we want to avoid MSG. But it turns out that there are glutamates in several other foods that we may not have realized. So that I thought was something different for people to know, that gluten was associated with worsening symptoms of OCD, and that there are things that you can embrace. So certain foods that had certain ingredients, like foods with glycine, foods that had vitamin B3 in them, vitamin B12 were very good. And turmeric again played a role. Turmeric came up a lot in different categories. But I think the fact that we understood that MSG and glutamates actually drove symptoms of OCD, I think has been really helpful for my patients to know about, and also being careful with gluten. So there are also foods that have glutamates, like ordinary foods like Parmesan cheese and mushrooms. And if you have a sudden diagnosis, then you might want to be more careful with those foods.
You know, putting the spotlight on the gut-brain connection and just how important our gut is, what is it that you want your colleagues in the medical field to know about when it comes to balancing out the use of antibiotics, when it comes for sort of their not very acute reasons of using them. Patient comes in, you're not really sure kind of what's going on. It's still very common that people kind of get just antibiotics, or even patients are coming in demanding antibiotics when especially, you know, yeah. So basically, what is it that you want people to know, both your colleagues and the listeners here, about, you know, how we should be careful about antibiotics and the role that they play in our gut bacteria?
Absolutely. So, you know, if someone has an infection and your doctor's recommending it, you want to have a conversation about that and, you know, make sure that you have a good reason. And I will say that I think our medical world has become much more responsible as we've understood more about the gut microbiome, about prescribing antibiotics. Interestingly, a more recent study showed that taking a probiotic, if you have to take an antibiotic, isn't necessarily that useful. I would say, have the discussion with your doctor. Remember that if for some reason you have a severe infection and you really need to take something, please know that you can eat for your better gut health. And some of the stuff we've talked about, anti-inflammatory foods, the fiber-rich foods, are actually things that will support your gut. So I think a balance of information, having the conversation with your doctor, and sometimes, you know, I think people feel intimidated and they don't necessarily want to say, well, is it really necessary for me to take this antibiotic? And I think if anything, I'd like consumers, patients to feel better about asking the questions. I certainly am always open to it if a patient asks me a question. And I hope other physicians would be too. But be informed is very important in terms of your condition.
When it comes to taking all this great information and kind of turning it into practical, like some sort of plan, how do you recommend for somebody who's new to this world and they're reading all this and the power of all these different foods, do they go to the supermarket and just get every food that's mentioned inside the book? Or do you recommend a plan of a way that they can start incorporating? Because part of this is potentially removing certain foods or reducing the amount of usage on them, like you were talking about sugar and other things like that. Another part is including certain things. So removing certain things and including certain things. What's the best way to go about it?
Sure. So, you know, there are specifics in each chapter that breaks down the diagnosis like you've shared. And in each chapter and diagnosis, I would say that, say you are struggling with something, say anxiety, I would start with that chapter and break down, look at the foods to embrace and the foods to avoid. That's one way to use the book. If you have a diagnosis or you know someone with that diagnosis, you can start just by looking at that chapter, taking the information and acting on it. But there are also some background pillars that I suggest that everyone try, because everyone's starting at a different point. And everyone has the ability to make small changes that will stick. So don't feel that if you're eating something that you're feeling regretful about that you can't change. Those pillars are simple things like including eating, you know, mostly whole foods. Really, my suggestion for that is, the example is, eat the orange, skip the orange juice, because you're avoiding the processed sugar and all the processing of that juice, but you're eating the orange full of rich nutrients and vitamins. The second thing is, you know, eat a varied diet, include a lot of plants and fruit in that. And the reason is that those bring back the fiber that your gut needs. The third is, eat a rainbow of colors. So that variety of colors of your fruit and vegetables brings in biodiversity to your gut. Then there are things around, you know, hydration, as well as making sure that you have good sources of protein, whether they be plant-based or animal-based. And those are sort of some pillars and building blocks that people should embrace. Another one is really the prebiotics and probiotics, which really go with the fiber component. But those simple things are things that you could start with one of those things today and start to make a difference to what you're doing.
That's fantastic. You know, I want to ask you a more personal question, if you feel like answering it. In the dedication of the book, you acknowledge, members of your family, including your mom. And you say, you know, this book is dedicated to my mom, who gave me the most important piece of advice in my life. Can we dig in a little bit, or at least have a hint of maybe what this advice is about?
I'm happy to share that. You're not the first person who's asked that. So I have this really interesting, fun story about it. My mom met my husband before I did, because she was his professor in medical school. And we were all in different classes. And, you know, I was doing what young women do at that age. And one of the days she came home and she said, you know, there's this really great young man in my class. I wish you would meet him. And I was like, Mom, I'm not going to take that advice. I want to find my way. And, she suggested it, and she knows me very well. She didn't push the agenda, but eventually we did meet, eventually I did meet my husband, and, it ended up working out. And she was very, very smart about how she managed me, because she didn't push the agenda and it wasn't an arranged marriage or anything like that. But the fact that she put that idea in my head, I think was very significant. And it was actually, she's given me a lot of great advice. I love my mom, but that was probably the best piece of advice that she gave me.
Oh, that's fantastic. So another follow-up question about family in general, especially for our listeners, as people start to dig into this information, they often get excited and they see the potential of how certain things help us, how certain things harm us, and they strengthen the connection between what they eat and how they feel. Now, one of the most challenging things in the world is to then support your family sometimes in this process, because food, especially if you come from a particular culture or background, food is actually as embedded into your being as like religion is often sometimes.
Absolutely.
And getting people to change their diet is almost like telling them to go from, instead of being a Muslim, become a Christian sometimes, right?
It can be very confusing.
Any tips as you've gone down this journey and as you've also gone down the culinary journey of having more of that connection with food, what's the best way to support family members in their process of health and improving their diets?
Sure. It depends on what your role in the family is. If you're the person who mostly does the shopping or the preparation, part of it is introducing, and even with kids, it's sort of introducing new things in a fun way. That to me is probably the best way to say it. We eat with our eyes first. So say your family doesn't like salad. How you present it, I've seen things like where the people, depending on the diet that they have, a really beautiful salad laid out with different colors and really things that looked attractive to eat and things that the family would recognize. Maybe if you eat animal proteins, you might have a chicken breast or you might have pieces of steak with it. But it's a way to introduce something different as well as have something usual. So you could do two things. Start to introduce new ways of how you introduce the type of food to your family and keep some staples, but up your game in terms of the nutritional value of those staples. So take, one of the Indian foods that we cook, which is made with cauliflower. Traditionally, it's made with ghee and a lot of spices and it can actually have a lot of oil. There are ways to make it healthier. You could roast it and still use the same spices, but you can also introduce other things to the diet that could be presented in a slightly different way. You could also use things like an air fryer oven, still keep those crispy treats that the family enjoys, but make them in an air fryer oven. You could do things that are fun, like kale chips for crunchy snacks, and do that oven bake so that there's something fun about it and that members of the family will come along with you, because you want to bring them along on a journey towards better health. But you can't go from burgers and fries on one night to a completely healthy meal the next night, meaning that you've got to do it slowly.
In the context of the current state of the world, there's a lot of emphasis that's been played, and we're dealing with two. I'll start off with this. We're dealing with sort of the pandemic of coronavirus, but we're also dealing with the mental health challenges that are coming with it and also that pre-existed before it. Since mental health is such a big component, not just for adults, for kids too, they're not in school, they're at home, there's a lot of pressures around the family. Mm-hmm. If you were added to the national team of advisors who were giving recommendations, and the same way they were talking about masks and other things, what would you share with families that are out there when it comes to supporting our mental health during this time? Would there be foods or recommendations that you would bring in? Would you talk about, what would you talk about?
So I think that I've been wondering about that, and I feel like where the information in my book could be helpful in these guidelines is that it can be preventative for people where we're facing so much uncertainty, and our many families are all together, either confinement, and different states have different levels of opening up. It could also be seen as an opportunity to really improve what we're doing in terms of our health. Studies have shown that when we eat meals at home, we eat healthier meals and that we consume fewer calories. So how about we think about embracing what we're doing? I know that it's not easy. There are a lot of challenges that we're facing, but how about we start with including some healthy habits in our diet and including foods that, you know, hit some high notes. If you love desserts, include super dark chocolates. The flavonoids are great for you. If you, if you're doing some cooking at home, adding things like pumpkin seeds for the iron or avocado for the magnesium or turmeric, like we've talked about earlier, Drew, you know, to foods that you wouldn't have thought of, like a soup or a smoothie, are ways to just add in some building blocks. There are certain foods that help stress. Omega-3 fatty acid foods, such as salmon, and their plant-based sources as well. The other is vitamin D-rich foods. And the third one is the turmeric and black pepper. So if you want to reduce our stress and anxiety, start with some building blocks that you can do. And what I would say to a panel of individuals is mental health is going to be one of our biggest concerns hereafter and moving forward. So anything we can do to help prevent the onset or worsening of symptoms can be one of the tools we have is through food.
I think it's a key, and I think it's important. And it's also, we need a little bit more maybe hope, you know, injected into the current state that we're in right now, especially as people are very fearful, and a lot more things that we can control. You know, there's so much exactly. things that we can't control, but it's a good diet, one. We can Something. Control some aspects of that.
Exactly. We all have to eat. My feeling is, you know, have your treat day, but why not try to eat healthier the rest of the time? Because for me, I care deeply about people's mental health. But the other good thing is it's going to help your physical health too. So if it's a win-win, why not do it?
Beautiful message. Fantastic book. It's out there and it's available to folks. They can order it on Amazon and everywhere that books are available. Any other places that you would want to direct our audience in addition to This Is Your Brain on Food book that will have the link for the show notes inside? Sure. You know, the blog and everything like that. Anywhere else that you want to direct our audience?
Sure. So we do a lot of social media and Instagram. We share a lot of science information that are linked to the studies I've spoken about and helpful tips. And that would be at Dr. Uma Naidoo. So at DrUmaNaidoo. And we're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. And you can go to my book site if you want more information, which is book.umanaidoomd.com. But the book is also available where I actually, due to COVID, I just got my copy a few days ago. So it looks like this.
And great cover, by the way. I love the cover.
Thank you. I think you have the digital copy, but yes. And it's also sold wherever books are sold. So you can get a copy there if you'd like.
That's fantastic.
And thank you for supporting.
Yeah. 10 years ago, did you think you'd be on social media presenting science of nutritional psychiatry?
Did not. I am very new to social media, but I've also realized, like you said earlier, there are helpful things you can do with social media. And my hope is that, you know, I'll share a funny story. We thought that people would love, with my background, people would love pictures of fancy dishes and delicious food. And people do like that on our Instagram following. But really, people started to follow us when we started to quote all the nerdy science around nutrition and say, did you know that this study helped with these gut bacteria for this reason? And people were all over it and really started to comment, and we gained a following that way. So I think that it can be used in a very positive way. I did not think I would be on social media 10 years ago, but I hope that if we can be, and be in a positive way and be sharing information, that it's useful to people.
Absolutely. And you're 100% making it useful. Dr. Naidoo, thank you so much for joining us here on the Broken Brain Podcast and sharing your wisdom with our audience. It's really an incredible intersection that you have, from culinary to psychiatry and the work that you're doing at Mass General. So I think a lot more people in the world that we live in, it's fantastic, because I think that when people like, when doctors with your background and your education speak up, I think a lot more people listen. So thank you for highlighting this important work.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. And I thank you for the invitation and support.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.